fast rise time, 1 megacycle square wave. And if we did it correctly, we could see 1 megacycle comb lines on a spectrum analyzer screen that went up to quite a few hundred megacycles. And every one of those comb lines is exactly 1 megacycle apart. That is the frequency content of a steeply rising waveform. So now that you recognized one of the mechanisms by which the undesired interference on other frequencies, or even on the desired frequencies, is coming out of your circuit, you've now got a bypass, you've got a shield, you've got a separate. In other words, you have to find out, you found what appears to be the source of the offending signal. Let me drop. You're eventually going to recognize the point of ingress. In other words, your offending signal is getting into a vulnerable circuit, microphone circuit, crystal oscillator circuit, low-level exciter stage of the transmitter, or whatever. Somehow it's getting into a circuit because the commonality of power supply, commonality of location, lack of shielding, and so on. All of radio is a fight, love and glory, a fight to get rid of all of the sources of interference, to properly shield them, to properly separate them, to use bypass capacitors, to use coaxial cables, to build boxes around them, to put them in the right locations, and so on. You have to find out who's vulnerable, how many volts per centimeter or volts per meter of E-field nearby, at what frequency is that circuit vulnerable, and your source of signal, how many volts per meter is it generating. This is the way it's done in the military world. Every chunk of electronics has to meet milli 5400, I think it is, for interference testing. In other words, what is the conducted EMI, what is the radiated EMI in volts per meter, millivolts, repetition rates, and so on. So there's some very exact ratings that every piece of military electronics must meet before it's allowed to be put onto your airplane or onto your submarine or whatever to make sure it doesn't stop everything else there from working. This gives me a little bit of a hint. I bet you Mel's got a couple of hints too. K2KEY, K2LIW in the tech net.
Said it pretty good, Dick. What he's going to do is have to look at the spectrum and see basically where it's coming, you know, how it's mixing in with the situation. What you can do, like you say, military electronics, there is a whole different story. But what you can do is what they call the four-man shield. It's just many cases what I've done is some of these war wars that seem to click away. I had one that, boy, it was a real beaut the way it's created a particular, like a, I wouldn't call it a buzz, but like a clicking noise. And simply what I just did is wrapped it in tin foil, Dick, and it made a phenomenal difference. Go ahead.
I believe it. Sometimes a very simple technique. I remember the Heathkit AR-3 receiver I built as a kit way back in 1956 was picking up signals in my shack that I didn't want it to pick up. The kit included a fiberboard wooden cabinet that you mounted this chassis of the radio in. It's a tube-type radio. It was a tube-type radio. I lined the inside surfaces of the wooden cabinet with tinfoil and was properly grounding that tinfoil to the chassis itself. The undesired interference that the radio was picking up got knocked down by 20 dB. That's a 100-to-1 ratio in power. So you'll eventually figure out how to do that, in my opinion, Rich. Sorry about that, Joe. But A2RYY, K2RIW in the tech net.
Okay, very good. Well, using a spectrum analyzer, using a spectrum analyzer, I found that the power coming into this thing seemed to be about, the field of energy is about, say, 0 dBm. Somewhere around there, like what I can measure with a small rubber duck held right next to the instrument. It was re-radiating a signal at about minus 70 to minus 80 dBm. And the interference is funny. It was only produced in a UHF range. It had a UHF excitation signal, but it only produced interference 1 meg apart in the UHF range, and say about 420 to about 520 megahertz, but being very strong within 10 meg of the applied carrier, plus or minus. So With all that, I guess I'm going to have to try something simple like tinfoil shielding. I have a comment on the question I was asking about last week about frequencies or measurement of frequencies. I'm not sure if I should go there with this today or not.
Hey, Joe, we're going to give you permission. Go and have some fun. Go ahead.
Okay, last week I said I was trying to measure some frequencies off the air to use as frequency standards because eventually the analog stuff is going to go off the other TVs, video carriers I've been using to try to lock my service monitor onto as far as something that seems to be known accurate. I did a similar kind of measurement again. Remember last week I told you I measured a couple frequencies off the air. Two of the frequencies seem to be the same frequency, so I was assuming that they were probably more correct than anything else, and I believe that's right. I had a chance to take the service monitor back into the site. I was measuring a 10 megahertz reference oscillator, which was clocked to a GPS receiver. All right, so that proved that what I was measuring, the frequencies off the air, was the same type of thing as what I was measuring from the particular wireless site. I had a chance to do the same thing within the past week, and I went back there again, and I used the assistance of this particular person, and now I took the same frequency information out of this reference oscillator and was able to introduce it into the back of the generator, which has the 10 hertz reference input, or clock input. And so that means it took over my internal clock inside the generator itself, all right? Now, the frequencies I measured off the air, which I thought were correct, did indeed become correct. They were measured exactly on frequency, the two particular video carriers. The other frequency I measured, which I was told by Eric, KE2EJ, was supposed to be a certain frequency, I measured that frequency at least 40 hertz higher in frequency than what it was supposed to be. That's what my question is, going back to all this kind of stuff. There's definitely a measurement difference that I seem to was exhibiting on the equipment there by a good 40 hertz or so.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to resolve that tonight unless Eric is on frequency. In a situation like that, you have to find out where is the bedrock, where is the datum point, who is the real reference, what's the closest you can get to a primary standard back to the cesium beam clocks at the National Bureau of Standards in Boulder, Colorado, or the NIST as it's now called, National Institute of Science and Technology. I keep forgetting. NIST will eventually figure out what that stands for. Anyhow, you're going to have to step by step find out who really has the truth here. Possibly we wrote down the numbers not exactly right that we heard from Eric. What's going to eventually happen, as Eric explained it, when we switch over more to digital television, more of the stations that are in the core, that means the digital TV high-def television channels that are below 54 megacycles roughly, they will be eventually all coming up to standard as to exact frequencies of that pilot tone. And I suspect you're eventually going to be using that pilot tone. When you use the 10 hertz output from the back of a piece of equipment, the good news is that you're getting 10 clicks per second. The bad news is that to listen to the phase shift of those is a lot slower than if you were doing a lizardry pattern at 1 megacycle directly or at 10 megacycles directly. My experience tells me that the higher the frequency you're comparing, the faster you will see the frequency error. It's unfortunate that certain pieces of equipment only give you access to a much lower frequency after it's been counted down. Therefore, you have to spend a much longer period of time to confirm the accuracy. Unless you're using some kind of a phase measuring system, which can measure sub-hertz, if you know what I mean, by dividing the frequency difference into degrees of difference in phase between signal A and signal B, and you watch the phase number in degrees climb or descend, and you know that somebody's higher or lower. I remember once I'm bringing home a frequency counter, and I was going to set the quartz crystal in my Omicron watch as accurate as possible. Didn't take me very long to find out that as I brought the probe of the frequency counter near the oscillating circuit inside the watch, I was adding extra capacitance, I was pulling the oscillator, I was contaminating the measurement that I was trying to make. The best accuracy measurement I could make, I soon discovered, was to set the clock as accurately as I could with WWV on one day, and then go downrange a day, a week, a month, or whatever, and find out if my clock was ahead or behind 1 second, and therefore I was able to reach in there, turn the little variable capacitor, advance it or retard it, and eventually get the clock. I got my little Omicron wristwatch to the point where it was accurate to approximately 1 second per week. And way back in 1970 or whenever it was that I was doing that, that was kind of accurate in that day. Maybe it was 1975. And I had a lot of fun with that kind of accuracy of a watch. And then I started taking it off my wrist at nighttime and putting it on the nightstand. And all of a sudden it lost 10 seconds per day instead of a second per week type stuff. In other words, the watch had to be held at a constant temperature of my body in order to get that kind of accuracy. In your case, you've got the reference oscillators that probably have a built-in oven, and that problem goes away. So your real problem now is to find out who is the closest to the primary reference and make sure that when Eric gave you a frequency, that we didn't write down the numbers wrong. If Eric is present, I'll give a little bit of a delay as we turn it back to you, Joe. W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
B2KY, that comment.
I was waiting to see if Eric was in there. No, you got it.
Who would think that the Federal Aviation Administration most likely is demanding some extreme accuracy because with the situation of crowded skies and all, and navigation problems, I would say that they most likely have had some kind of problem with accuracy, that they have most likely ironed out, and somewhere I'm sure they have, are at very tight standards, Dick, over.
Yeah, after we do some investigation, we might find out that you're right, Mel. A VOR station, a glide slope generator, a beacon generator, whatever, there's all kinds of signals being generated around and near airports. But some of those signals don't need extreme accuracy unless you're doing automatic location of other aircraft. There have been various schemes where a reference signal is sent from the ground to the individual aircraft, and by some means of comparing amplitudes and phases and time delays and whatever, each pilot could eventually get a display on his screen as to how near is the nearest aircraft, how many miles away, and what is the closing rate, to know whether or not you've got to take a corrective action. So there were some of those automatic locating systems that were dependent on extreme accuracy. But the other signals around airports, I'm not convinced right now, have that kind of accuracy. Wonder if you've investigated so far any of the FAA frequencies, Joe. W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
No, Dick, I have not investigated those, but I would probably say that those things don't need to be that precisely put on frequency and kept on frequency. It was very easy to use my equipment. I have a range of at least one or two airports that I could see that kind of stuff. I know about where to look for them on the band, but I don't think I'm going to see the frequency accuracy there, like you said, because it doesn't demand it to be there. So I'm just going to have to wait and see as more of these stations go up from analog to digital, what the end up, the end result ends up being with like this. And okay, so that's enough of that. The two comments I had was one: since I'm coming in from the IROP, or actually from the internet, sometimes you guys don't leave a lot of space, and even like when you transmit right when you hear the beep, you can't get in from the internet. Because there's somebody here last week who was trying to get it from me from the IRLP, the reflector you guys just got your repeater tied to, which is what I'm talking on right now, and he could not get in several times. Once he got in, he was recognized, and he just, like, skipped over. And he had some questions about DTV signals from with Eric. and he totally missed his chance. He got, that was that. So you do have to leave a little bit of time because the VHF repeater has priority over the internet. If you transfer on VHF, you will definitely knock the guy in the IR up to you right off if he heard on your repeater. Where's Eric?
And Eric, you could use a little bit more rodeo. And I think it was Mr. MIT last week that I completely bypassed, and I shouldn't have done that. I'll leave enough Eric and leave enough delay and pick up Eric and give us a little more rodeo. KE2EJ, KQRIW in the tech man.
KQRIW, KE2EJ. Yeah, down the hall I heard you kept saying my name, so I figured I'd come and find out what you were talking about.
Okay, Joe made another measurement, and he thinks that you're, I think it was channel 22, pilot tone, he thinks was 40 hertz different in his measurement versus what you believe you had measured, and he had gone to a cell site which is GPS locked, and he was convinced that his IFR was on the money. So there's a little bit of a mystery there. There's no easy way to resolve it yet. Over to you, Eric, in case you've got some comments on that.
Right, well, the frequency you gave me last week, by the way, is channel 55, which is not on any kind of a standard. It's a small transmitter that has a crystal offset. So, accuracy is not there. You know, I have a history with trying to measure the frequency of the pilot. There's enough stuff going on in the system, you know, that you have edges you can make a question. All I know is I know what the reference is, and it's divided down, that's what the post is going to have to be. But, you know, we can use as a magic number, cesium 133. Because when I was playing with it, I had my cesium oscillator. And that runs at 9.12 something. I have it down there somewhere. Yeah, 9.192 gigahertz. I think that's kind of, and actually it's many bits of that. It's a precise number. And the atoms of cesium 133 only change their state at that precise frequency.
Yeah, I've heard that. I've seen some of these charts done by the National Bureau of Standards where they give you the exact frequency of the dual lobes of the cesium beam 133 oscillation resonance, or whatever you want to call it, atomic resonance. And I think they carry it out to 10 or 12 decimal places, the exact frequency that oscillates at. And I think you're telling me that in New York you have one of those reference oscillators at channel 13. I vaguely remember that Dr. Bill Baker was demonstrating that to me during one of my visits there. I am curious, Joe, by the way, Eric, I do recommend that you give us a little bit more rodeo. You're backing away from that particular mic, and you're giving us about 20% of the amount of volume you should be giving us. Even Mel could give us a little bit more audio. I do recommend, Mel, that you go once in a while and listen to your and my audio playback at amateurradio.tv, and you will find that your audio, as it's recorded, is quite a few dB weaker than mine. So your particular microphone circuit could either be turned up a little bit louder, or you could speak a little bit closer to the mic. And Erica, there were times there when you were speaking very softly in that last transmission. Let me turn it back to Joe with a question which he may not be able to answer for me, and that is, what accuracy does he think he needs? Now, there are people who, as a hobby, let me drop.
Comment W2EWK.
Eugene recognized, and we're going to get to you in a second, in about a minute, Eugene. There are people who have accepted the hobby of seeing what accuracy is possible. And one of my buddies who used to live in Connecticut was using satellite transmission, synchronous orbit satellites connected to a network, and getting some very precise frequency measurements and comparing that to broadcast stations and whatever. As a hobby, it was kind of a fun thing to do. So possibly you're doing it as a hobby and you'd like to get down to a fraction of a hertz at 10 gigs. Then again, you might be on a specific project that requires a certain number of hertz of accuracy at 1 gigahertz. I wonder which one it is, Joe. Make sure you give enough delay so that a person can get in. That means you are YY, KQRYW in the deck net.
I'm duplex, so I can definitely hear somebody going on top of me or something going on top of them. I think I told you to answer that question last week. 1 hertz at 1 gig would be perfectly fine for me. First of all, the equipment can't really resolve anything less than 1 hertz at 900 meg or 1 gig to begin with, so that would be perfectly fine for me. I was wrong on what I said before about 40 hertz. I said should have said about 25 hertz because he said the frequency of his carrier was 524.309440.559. Which would mean if I put my IFR on 524.3094, which is what it's capable of doing, that's the maximum number of digits, I would have seen his offset correctly at plus 40 hertz. It read plus 65 hertz. I wasn't 40 hertz error, it was 25 hertz error. All right? When I corrected my equipment to his frequency, so it read, 65. And I went back to these other TV carriers, they were lower frequency. And I went back to WWV at 15 megahertz using an outside antenna, and I definitely got a variation in my signal on the IFR when it's in the SSB mode at 15 megahertz. I could definitely see a wavering between my frequency and it. When I put my IFR back to the two TV signals that they seem to be of known accuracy, now WWV can... My radio timing up. Now WWV gave me a variation of maybe once every 20 seconds I would see the signal change. And I was also looking at the analyzer at the same time to see was getting a fade out with the signal conditions changing. I was getting a fairly constant signal. I was getting, like once every 20 seconds I would see the signal, zero beat with WWV. So that told me I was pretty good as far as frequency at 15 meg when I was aligned to the two other frequencies at VHF. So that's basically about it. So, I just like looking to find out who's right and who's wrong. Is what I'm measuring, is that correct? And Eric, I guess you're coming here a little late. I take my service monitor and I not only measure, last week I measured the clock frequency inside a cell site which has a GPS receiver tied to a 10 megahertz output clock that runs the site. I not only measured that at 900 megahertz through many harmonics of that 10 megahertz signal and found to be, when it adjusted the generator to be read correctly at that frequency, but I had a chance to take it in the previous week, and use that signal into the back of my instrument, which has a 10 megahertz input. I used it as my internal clock, and I got the same kind of results with these two video carriers from Channel 9 and Channel 11. They appear to be exactly on frequency. Your channel 13 output seems to be about 5 hertz high in frequency. The frequency I measured at your 524.3094 seems to be about 65 hertz high in frequency instead of 40 like what you said it should be. I'm really also trying to do all this kind of stuff is just resolve it to the point where I can say I have something on the air I can align this thing to. Until I can come up with some other way of getting a hold of a 10 megahertz clock that syncs the GPS to use it as a standard. That's what I'm trying to do really right now.
I see a problem, Joe. Stand by a second. Eric read out a set of numbers to you last week, 12 decimal places, starting off at 529-309-440-559. You came back last week and told us 524. And we corrected you to 529. Tonight you came back with 524 again. You may be measuring some other component. Either that or I wrote it down wrong. Let's see if Eric is on frequency. I think Eric gave us a 529-309-440-559. KE2EJ, KQRIW in the tech net.
And KQRIW, KE2EJ.
You know what? Let me pull up the page. I'm finding it'll take me a minute. And
I'll give you the exact numbers again. These are the standards that they come out with. Although I gotta say, even though the pilot's 3 dB higher than everything, I don't put too much faith in grabbing that edge repeatedly because of all the other stuff that's going on around it.
Well, if the service monitor's cable measuring AM, FM, or SS being an AM, it seems to be much more stable when looking at a video carry. It does not wander around in frequency that way.
Yeah, well, there's another issue going on, and that's called jitter. And nobody's jitter-free, so that can make counters a little bit erroneous at times. Hang on, let me get you the exact numbers.
Yeah, Dick, while he's looking up those numbers, the other subject, I thought you were going to talk about 1 week or a couple weeks ago. I'm not sure who was going to bring up the subject with you or Andy about using the Bessel function to measure deviation with respect to mileage. I would find that very interesting to go through that, but not tonight, of course.
Yeah, we've got that on our list. And when the night occurs that Andy is present, because he's the one asking the question, we're going to go through the process of using something like the charts that are the Bessel functions for, you'll find them in the reference data for radio engineers, among other respective texts, and there's got to be a number of websites that's got it. How do you convert those numbers into a prediction of where the carrier null occurs, what is the amplitude of individual side lobes, and so on. So we're going to go through that process, and it's not a direct process. You'd like to believe that each one of those Bessel numbers that are in the spreadsheet in the reference data book represents decibels down from carrier. That's not what it represents. You got to do some mathematics in each one of those numbers to boil them into how many dB down is the individual side lobes. Let's stand by for Eric, and I wonder if there really was a confusion there with 529 instead of 524. Because I heard those exact same numbers being used somewhat in error back and forth last week. And maybe it got written down the wrong way, got corrected, but you didn't find the correction when you found that piece of paper. K2EJ, we'll wait for you. K2RIW in the tech
man. Front quickie, comment.
Hang on. Wanted to know, actually, I pulled out a paper that's all about, creating a narrow bandwidth to measure the wind power. Higher location bandwidth is, this is something that's way up lower end. It's 309-440-559 Hertz.
Okay, and was the basic number in front of that 529 or 524, and I think different components can be measured depending on which that is. Now back to you, Eric. By the way, Eric, you're giving us very little audio.
Is there enough audio here now, or is there something wrong with this thing?
Fantastic audio now. You came up 15 dB, and I'm not kidding.
Okay, I apologize. It's me. That's the pilot from the band aid. Now, what frequency are we talking about? 22?
There was a number you gave us last week of 529, and then you gave us the 309-440-559. And then I do remember last week, as I said, I heard you say 529. Joe had written it down as 524, and tonight again he's quoting 524. So I'm a little bit concerned about whether or not he's measuring from the other edge. Let's see, this 5 makes, I wonder if he's possibly measuring some other component. You're concerned that it's a very complicated signal with all kinds of things around it, and picking out the tone independent of all that other stuff could create some confusion. Back to you, Eric.
Alright, okay, if you want to go the other direction, it's 5.05, it's 5059. 440.559 hertz from the other edge. And that's the top edge of the pilot. Now, where you said 529, in fact, it's not registering with me, and I don't see it anywhere.
I think the 529 is the number of megacycles in front of the offset for the edge of the band or something like that. There was a 529 number that I heard last week coming from you before the 309-440-559. And then I got corrected to 524 or the other way around. So I think we're talking about the exact number of megacycles here as opposed to megacycles from the band edge. Maybe that's some of the confusion. Back to you for any other comments, Eric.
Yeah, all right. I know what we're talking about. I just have to look that up now. Why don't you pick up the other stations for a second? I'll be right back.
Okay. I'm going a little bit too fast. Make sure you give enough delay, Eugene. W2EWK, give enough delay and give us your comment, Eugene.
My comment is on the Zenith boxes. I bought two Zenith boxes. I stay late for the coupon. I got two coupons, and I bought two Zenith boxes. Okay, that's number one. Number two, I got two more certificates coming. I got two certificates in my mother's name. So I'm good now. I got one for each TV. I'm willing to give whoever wants the certificate free of charge. There's no charge for the certificates, whoever wants them. I'll be more than happy to give whoever wants the certificate of my mother's name away for free. To yourself?
Very nice offer, Eugene. We're all going to keep that in mind as we eventually go out there and either buy a TV or a converter. These certificates are only good for a person who buys a converter box for over-the-air broadcast reception of digital TV signals that are going to be converted from over-the-air antenna into an old-fashioned 4x3 television set. And these certificates, to my knowledge, cannot be applied to a brand new digital television, high-def television, if you buy it. Maybe Eric is back now. He can either confirm or deny what I just said, and maybe he's found the information he's looking for. KE2EJ, with a little delay. K2RYW in the TechNet.
PWK.
Okay, I picked up the wrong microphone. That doesn't help. All right, the number is 518 for the low band. It's 518 megahertz, right? And it goes to 6 megahertz. So 518 plus 304 gets you your pilot frequency. There is actually a couple sites. One's called DTVAnswers.com. There's another one called DTVAntenna.com. And there they have all the details about the coupons. The coupons are good for $40 towards the converter box, which means that if you buy a Radio Shack one, you're going to spend $16. So, and I think they're just about out of them. They're talking about printing more of them, so. And they went really fast. K2RWK, Drew, yes.
Okay, good pieces of information. You got any further questions here, Joe? W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Yes, I do. With this number he just talked a little too fast before. I was trying to write it down. I'm just trying to get a confirmation of what this number is. Is it 524.309-440-559 or 309-4559?
What I heard him say is 318.304-449-440-559. I think he's now giving us the exact frequency, and I think he's giving us 15 decimal places. 518. This is in megacycles. 309-440-559. I wonder if I got it right this time, Eric. Go ahead.
Green, no bugs on me.
Yeah.
It's 518-09-440-559.
Okay, and you have reason to believe that that particular transmitter right now is either cesium beam locked or GPS locked and putting out that particular frequency. Is that the best of your knowledge right now, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, at the moment it's GPS locked. At the time you were 13 and you saw the cesium clock, actually I got like five of them, I had two of them, but they're not using them all anymore. They're on lousy crystals. You know, this stuff walks around, but you gotta understand that today, the way we get video from one place to another, you may lock your plant up in your house to a very precise precision standard. By the time you get to the transmitter, after you've crushed it and turned it into MPEG and some other garbage, it's completely reclocked. It has no relationship to whatever you did in the studio anymore.
Now, in the back in the old analog days, there was something called the time-based corrector, which tried to set frame by frame or field by field everything straight. I guess there is no equivalent to that in DTV. Is that true, Eric?
All right. I'll give you the short answer, because I can give you the long answer. The time-based corrector actually is by every 64 microseconds. See, when you put the video signal down on a piece of tape, you're dealing with a mechanical device that's got a spinning head so you can get the writing speed up so you can get the bandwidth out of it. You also have the geometry of the tape, which is a piece of a ton of plastic with, you know, powdered iron glued to it. So its geometry, its shape is never perfect. And it changes as the head penetrates the tape and it stretches it a little bit, puts a little bump into it. So even though on paper the tracks are perfect, but when you go and you play that back, okay, you get something called time-based error. But it's sort of like as though you took a rubber band and you stretched it and let it loose and stretched it and let it loose, and you're supposed to be making 1,000 hertz, and each time you're stretching it and making it loose, you're making it go down to 900 hertz, you're making it go up to 1,100 hertz. So the idea of the time-based corrector is what we do is we know that in between video lines is exactly 64.3 microseconds worth of time. So because our sync pulses are there, we can actually, in an analog domain, we used to do this, by the way, with glass delay lines and other some neat tricks, coils and varactors and capacitors, because of the 64 microseconds, you would actually store that. And then what you would do is clock it out at the correct constant rate. And that's what a time-based corrector is for, to overcome the mechanical difficulties of playing back a mechanical device. There it dropped. So in today's world, where we turn the original video into other stuff, and by the way, as you get away from VHS, that's the last format which has time-based error in a traditional sense. If we go to like mini-DV, which is in the camera, it's really a digital format. And basically what you're doing is you're shuffling out bits and stuffing them into a latch and hanging on to them for a second and clocking them out at a constant rate. So in today's world, there is no such thing as time-based error anymore, unless, of course, you're working with some form of analog tape machine, which there's still a lot of. But the point that I'm trying to make is by the time you get your signal to the transmitter, all that nice timing that you might have created back down the line no longer means anything because you've turned it into MPEG. You've completely disconnected it from any kind of reference, which in the case of color video is the subcarrier or the color burst. It's the magic thing that makes it work. And you can't carry that to the transmitter. So whatever you're doing at the transmitter, you need a local, very stable source if you want to be a frequency reference. At the time you came to Channel 13, things were still analog. And I was making very, very ultra-precise 3.58, you know, 545-7949, blah, 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 I can't remember anymore, but that was very precise to, I think, like, 10 to the minus 3 after it went through everything. Those days are gone. K2RIWK2.
Yeah, I burned that number into my memory. 3.58 579-545-4544. Okay. I would guess now that with high-def television, the up-to-the-minute cameras these days are either doing purely solid-state recording or hard drive recording of a digital signal. Is that somewhat true, Eric? Go ahead.
Okay. There was a time where you went to a TV station, there were the poor people running around, putting tapes in tape machines, looking at the clock, making sure that each tape machine rolled at the proper time. And even as you got into the 80s, you began to see automation systems which would naturally roll the tape, and they had cart machines for some of the tapes. Today, I'll give you an example, the way stations are, is that I have a friend who runs a station in Hawaii, and a public television station. They basically load everything up, lock the door on Thursday, and don't come back until Monday. Channel 13 and Channel 21 coming off of, let's see, coming off of 250 gig drives being driven by a bunch of computers which have the automation system on it, which actually drive all the components of the chain. Most of the stations today run under automation, and they're basically running from one of four manufacturers' varieties of video storage devices. Like, we've got 3.6 terabytes in a cluster that's sort of like four groups to braid five. I mean, an entire cluster can fail and you don't lose any programming. There's some really neat stuff going on in that world.
KQRWK2J.
Yep.
Electronics is here to stay.
And
it ain't getting simpler. Okay, we did skip over Tim, KC2LIM. I wonder if you're there, Tim. If so, give us your call letters right now, KQRIW in the TechNet. Okay. Paul, I know you have a space report, and I think now is a good time for it. WS2N, if you're available, Paul. KQRIW in the TechNet.
Okay, fine business, Dick. Very good. And, last week we talked I mentioned the Phoenix spacecraft. I think it's the third week of this month. I don't have the date on that. That would be landing on Mars in the northern hemisphere. It's going to have a big arm on it. It's going to dig into the soil, looking for frost and ice. And we're waiting for that. It's in the cruise stage. They've only made one mid-course correction throughout this whole time, this whole six-month period. So they're right on target. And the final landing will be determined by the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is taking high-resolution pictures. That thing is like much better than the Odyssey or the Mars Global Surveyor that is presently in orbit when Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter showed up there. A year or so back, it went into aerobraking and finally got into its proper parking orbit. The resolution, you could see it. You got a picnic table on the planet, you could see it. So they've already relocated their landing site a little bit because there were some boulders and things that might get in the way when they tried to land Phoenix. Let me drop it a second. I wanted to mention STS-124. That's not STS-125. 125 will be probably late August. That will be the Hubble repair mission. But this is 124. This is set for the very end of this month. Discovery is going up. It's now at the launch pad. The payload itself is also at the launch pad. It comes out in a big container and eventually is put into the shuttle at the launch site, not in the in the building. The payload is the Kaibo, or the second part of the Kaibo component Japanese contribution to the International Space Station. The last one went up on the last flight. The smallest component, our room, good size area where you know where people will be. But the main living quarters and airlock will be sent up. They have their own airlock, by the way. It will be sent up on this mission. This thing is like 35 feet long. It's a little longer than that. But it's 37 feet long and almost 15 feet wide. It's going to be the biggest lab put onto the space station so far. So that's pretty good. Let me drop it. There will be a third probe that'll go up probably at the end of this year or the beginning of next year. An outdoor, let's call it a patio research area, which will be attached to the lab, to this particular Tybo lab. So it's three sections, three actual shuttle missions are sent up for this whole setup that that Japan has built for the space station. You have seven astronauts on board, one woman, and the average age is like 44 years old. Many of the people that are going up never went up before. I think there's five that never went up. They will be bringing one of the astronauts back down that's on the space station that was brought up last time. And they'll leave one behind. They'll have three EVAs up there. The first one will be to get the orbital boom assembly back into the space shuttle. Last space shuttle that went up there, they left this extension piece up there, put extension piece up there because they needed to have room in the space shuttle for this gigantic cylinder lab that's going up there. Just not enough room. The first time they had to do that. First thing they'll do when they get there is do an EVA and reattach this boom that's been attached temporarily to the space station back into the space shuttle. And this way they can do their inspections of the space shuttle, make sure the tiles are okay, and what they normally do are have lasers on there and cameras, high resolution cameras. They can tell that, you know, their spacecraft is in good shape. We drop it to WS2M. Now, same day, after this EVA, they're going to use the robotic arms, a series of robotic arms that are on the space station and on the shuttle to lift the Kaibo Bay and put it into its position. They're going to attach it to the Harmony node, that's one of the pieces that went up there. If you flight back, there's two nodes up there, the original one was Unity, and then this one is called Harmony. They can give a name. What it is a multi-port section which connects all the other parts of the space station to link each thing to one another. So each one has like six ports. It's like a spherical dice. Got six sides on a dice. That's what this is like. And they could attach different parts of the space station to the different ports. So they'll attach to the Harmony for some of the location. Then they'll have another EVA to go out and do some cleanup work. They remove covers and install covers onto different components. One of the parts going up is another robotic arm. So by Japan, which will be permanently attached to this Kaibo research lab. And then on day 7, they're going to actually take the module that was already left, brought up there last time. So that's stored in a temporary location as well, and that will be permanently mounted to the top of this the new big lab that's going up. So that's pretty much it, on the SDS-124 Discovery mission. One other thing I wanted to mention is the LRO, that's the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter that's going up near the end of this year. We drop it to WS2N. The LRO, or Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, will be put up into polar orbit at the end of this year. It'll be launched by an Atlas V rocket, naturally unmanned, but this is a preliminary flight with all kinds of equipment on board to photograph the moon in different dimensions that they've never done before. They're going to get a terrific amount of information on it. One of the things they would like to find is there any frost or ice on the moon, especially in the north or southern pole. And they have half a dozen different instruments on board. The Lyman Alpha mapping project is an ultraviolet camera, which is going to be looking for ice or frost. And then they have other different detectors. They have a cosmic ray telescope, they call it Crater, for detecting radiation, you know, how much radiation different parts of the moon are going to get. How can they protect the astronauts when they do go and eventually return to the moon? So they have that detector. They have a lunar radiometry experiment, which is really a fancy radar type of thing, which is going to take different pictures and then through computer graphics create very fine three-dimensional map. This will help for future landing sites where you're going to land. And Russia also contributed to this. They put on board a lunar exploration neutron detector and other things that look for ice and frost in the moon's surface. And then you've got the actual lunar reconnaissance orbiter camera, which is a real high resolution, you know, camera for detecting where you're going to land future missions on the moon. WS2N, let me drop it. One other piece of technology that's going up, kind of a test piece of technology. It's called a mini RF technology demonstration experiment. I find it's going to be a radar type of thing, also looking for ice underneath the surface. But its main purpose is potential communications. You know, when they go up, last rovers that went up on Apollo never really journeyed further away than 6 miles. The future rovers, when we return, will probably go maybe 50 or 60 miles away from the landing site. And that would probably sometimes put them out of radio range with the existing base on the moon. So they're going to need some kind of satellites going around, and they want to test out different methods of doing that. This will be a polar orbit, and naturally you're going to need probably a number of satellites to accomplish this, because you'll be out of range. The satellites won't be in range all the time. So they're thinking about things like that. Pretty interesting stuff. It'll be a one-year mission with a possible extension of 3 years. So the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. I mean, there is a presently there is a satellite in lunar orbit right now put up by Japan, but nothing with the high-tech instruments that are going to be on board this one. I mean, to back to that, this is WS2N, but it's a portion of this technology.
Quite good, Paul. I have the impression that one of the important portions of this mission is to recognize the fact that at the north pole of the moon and the south pole of the moon, there are some deep craters where the sun never shines into the bottom of that crater. As such, they are hoping that there's going to be water in frozen form buried below the soil or sitting in the bottom of that crater. And if water is discovered on the moon, it puts you way ahead of the game when it comes to sustainable human beings, sustaining human beings. The water can be used after refinement, not only for all the purposes that water is needed with human beings, but also I think it's a possible ingredient for making rocket fuel. So I'm a bit skeptical because it is my belief that water in a hard vacuum will continuously sublime. Sublime means that the molecules boil off from the solid state directly to the gaseous state without even going through the liquid state. That water in a hard vacuum does not remain is my belief. Well, I used to believe that. And then I listened to these reports where, let me drop, NASA is dumping water overboard on the space shuttle, and a chunk of ice will stick at the exhaust port. Well, maybe the ice contains other foreign materials that's making it stick, but still, there have been examples of ice forming on the outside of the space shuttle that doesn't boil away at any reasonable length of time. So then again, maybe water could exist on the moon. So am I correct in assuming that they sure hope they find water, because if they don't have to transport water for them to the moon, the next time the astronauts go there, life could be an awful lot simpler. And of the reports you've read, Paul, has anyone made any prediction as to the probability that these craters on the moon might contain water? WS2N, K2RIW, detect that.
Out of all the satellites that have gone up there, it started with the Prospector, actually a little bit before that, something called Coming Time. That was a military flight. These things have detected hydrogen and coal with their detectors. So hydrogen is, if they have, there might be a chance that it's probably not chunks of ice. I'm thinking maybe it's just graded in the ground below the surface. It could be right below the surface or maybe even a couple of feet down. Could it be mined out and get the force of ice out? Most likely in the craters in the North Pole, or maybe in the South Pole. That's where they want to land people first, by the way. The early flights aren't going to be in the equator like all the other half a dozen flights that we did, manned flights that we sent up where we roughly equatorial. We're heading for the pole because there could very well be ice there. And then even if there isn't, the poles are a better location for really continuous communication, more or less, mostly anyway, with the Earth for longer periods of time than they possibly imagine with the astronomy that they want to do. The poles would be the better place to be. A number of reasons, whether they're forced there or not, they like to go to the pole. And they'll probably mine it up if it does exist. And a lot of people say, well, okay, there it is, and they're going to magically put this together. It would be probably decades before you could ever actually have a plant up there and start converting all the ice to water and then separate it to hydrogen and oxygen and then compress it to liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen and duplicate, your engines on your space shuttle. That's what they run on. The external tank has liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. Of course, now you can breathe this stuff, you can drink this stuff, you can wash your spaceship with it, that would be a very important thing. And then the other important thing, you put in the radiation, you can be solar flares coming out. Where do you go? You're gonna have a lead room that you're gonna hibernate in there. An event is over. No, I don't think so. What they'll eventually do is start digging into the moon and creating big buried under the moon.
Repeater, time out.